Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. And welcome to the very first members bonus of 2023. And Dominic, I guess a special welcome to all the people who may have been given membership by Santa or by loved ones.
Absolutely. Happy Christmas, everybody. Happy New Year. It's great to be back talking to you live, as it were, because we had a week off, didn't we, Tom?
Very scandalous. Behavior. Yes, we did. Shocking. And this is kind of, this is a novel arrangement for us, isn't it? Because actually, although we're recording this on separate screens, we're in the same house.
We are. It's very peculiar. So, Tom, you've just been up to your sort of...
Our Scottish estate, as I like to
think. Yeah, your Scottish baronial estate.
Yes.
In Berwick and the borders of England and Scotland.
Sorting out all the festive burst pipes.
Nice.
So we got there and had to cut up all the carpet and take it off to the dump. So that was fun.
Sounds very glamorous.
Yeah.
And we have come for a few days to Northumberland, which is where you have joined us, in the lovely little town of Warkworth. We're in the shadow of this fantastic castle, actually, Tom. Did you see the castle as you drove in?
It's impossible not to see it. I mean, I think it's one of the great approaches to a castle anywhere in England, perhaps anywhere in the world, because you come over this bridge and there it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything that you would want from a kind of menacing medieval castle looming up. And that's, you know, that's what Northumberland is brilliant for.
It is. So, Sam, in a sort of briefing document for today's podcast, has asked if we've been to Lindisfarne. And I've never been to Lindisfarne, but you have, Tom. Have you been this time?
No, we didn't go this time. We were going to go on Sunday, and I misread the tide. So it's an island, and when the tide is out, you can go over on the road. And we got there, and the road was absolutely underwater. So we turned around and went for a very, very picturesque and romantic walk on this beach, actually, Dominic, that I was just recommending to you that you should go to.
Yeah.
So it's midway between Bamburgh Castle to the south, Lindisfarne with its picturesque Lutyens Castle to the north, and you gaze out towards the Farne Islands, very, very kind of like a turnerscape. You could imagine the Vikings sweeping towards you. The whole region is so brilliant. It's a wonderful place for both of us to have weirdly rendezvoused.
Yes, exactly. Well, I tell you what, whenever we come to Northumberland, what always strikes me is how long England is.
Yes.
In an underappreciated way.
Well, especially on the east side.
Yeah, crazy.
It's that much higher.
You get to sort of Leeds or something. I mean, Northerners will be horribly offended by this talk. But you get to Leeds, you think, I'm kind of in the north now. And there's hours still to go.
Yeah, but Dominic, I'm also thinking of all the Americans and Canadians and Australians who are just laughing hysterically you know, 400 miles is a long way.
It's a long way if there's a lot of stuff, though. That's the difference, isn't it? That in Canada, you can drive for 400 miles and see nothing.
Well, beaver.
But yes, you can see a lot of beavers. A lot of beavers. But there's that expression, deep England, isn't there? The idea about England being a very kind of deep country. That, you know, going back historically, layer upon layer. But also, there's just a lot of stuff. It's a very densely populated.
And I think that if you have any interest in history, that's why Northumbria and also the Scottish border region. I mean, the history is so thick because, of course, for centuries and centuries, people have been killing each other along here.
Yes.
So it's absolutely. I mean, Hadrian's Wall to the south, Scottish castles, English castles, yep. Scottish castles that were English that then became Scottish that then became English. All kinds of fun.
Yeah. All kinds of fun, lots to see. And Sam Brooke Jr. has brought his PlayStation, so that shows his commitment to
Oh, he must be interested in the castle.
Yeah, he likes the castle. He likes the castle, that's definitely.
But he hasn't been out yet, because you got up, you arrived here yesterday, didn't you? And I'm in the process of going back down south to London today.
So it's very Holland-Sam Brooke dynamic, isn't it? That within, you know, a few hours of arriving in a place,
we're doing a podcast.
Hours and hours away from where I live, Tom Holland arrives on my doorstep demanding breakfast.
I know.
It's like sort of Thorin Oakenshield type scenario, you know? I'm very much Bilbo Baggins.
Do you know what, Dominic?
Yeah.
Catherine very kindly brought in milk and I just spilt it all over the table.
Oh, no, Tom.
So so just carry on and tell the listener something interesting while I just mop it up.
Well, this is very opening scene of The Hobbit behaviour, Tom. Anyway.
But also for the new listeners, this is an exciting glimpse into the discipline and the quality of the kind of episodes that they can now look forward to getting.
So this Christmas, I think it's fair to say, has been quite kind to the rest of history. The Times newspaper did their list of the top podcasts of the year.
And if James Marriott, if you are out there listening, yeah, we love you.
My word.
Unconfinedly. So, Dominic, just explain what James said while I mop this up.
So James Marriott, who is the podcast critic of the Times, named The Rest Is History as the podcast of the year, which was very nice of him. And then about 3 days later, I woke up to see a text or a WhatsApp message from one of our producers saying, Marriott strikes again, or something like that. And in the Times, he had written an article specifically about his obsession with The Rest Is History, which he said that young people of his acquaintance now ask themselves, not are you a Gryffindor or a Slytherin or whatever, but are you a Holland or a Sandbrook?
What do you think the basis would be for deciding whether you're a Holland or a Sandbrook?
It's all about...
Do you eat roast beef or do you eat ragouts with Frenchified sauces?
That's exactly what it is, Tom. That's exactly what it is. And I think some people would say these slightly contrived personae. Yes.
Well, talking of contrived personae, the Times wasn't the only newspaper, was it, to feature a big article on The Rest Is History, because that noted paper of record, The Daily Mail, also featured
His Majesty's
a big article.
Daily Mail.
And it was written in the tone of objectivity and neutrality for which the Daily Mail is famous. And who was it wrote that article, Dominic?
So I wrote that, Tom. So as you know, when James Marriott wrote his article in the Times, the Daily Mail waited about 4 hours before saying, right, will you write that article now about yourself, please? In the way that they often work. So the Daily Mail are not always keen on being first to something, but they very much like to have also had their say on it. So if somebody else is...
So the jackals get in there first.
Yeah.
And then the lion arrives. The stake is claim on the disemboweled carcass. Yes.
Exactly. And so I said on our Western History WhatsApp group to the producers, I'm going to do this. You can all look forward to it or something. And then there was some degree of banter, I think it's fair to say, about what the headline would be. And
well, it was even worse than our worst imaginings.
Well, it wasn't worse than my worst imaginings. I was very happy with the headline.
Why our podcast is absolutely brilliant and the woke BBC deserve to be put out of their misery was basically the drift. And there was a large picture of Winston Churchill with a machine gun, which very much gave yeah. And I'm not complaining about that, because obviously it's targeting people at the Daily Mail who would go for that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it began with my favourite ever Daily Mail comment, which is something also my dad had said to me when you asked me to do this podcast, which is, what's a podcast?
Yes. Yeah, well, we know now. Anyway, so that's been great. So we're very happy about that. It was a great Christmas for one's ego, I think it would be fair to say.
Yes, I think it's fair to say we have more listeners now than we've ever had. And that's not just... So there's some sort of discussion about why that is. Goalhanger podcast Theo is reminding us on our chat. He says Christmas number one as well, and that's right, on Christmas Day.
I want listeners to know that these episodes, we don't just spend the whole time boasting and patting ourselves on the back, do we? We really don't.
We do actually, but there you go. So we're the Christmas number one. Now, why is it we did the World Cup series, I think, which was quite successful. I think we had a lot of help from... sort of divine source.
Yes.
So Jesus, we did Jesus just before Christmas and that attracted a lot of listeners. And then we had what I thought were two of our most reflective and affecting episodes, which I listened to yesterday as we were driving up to Northumberland, with Jonathan Friedland talking about Rudolf Werber, who escaped Auschwitz, and then talking about why the Allies didn't act on Werber's report and bomb the train lines again to Auschwitz.
And also why he didn't become like Anne Frank or whatever, a kind of icon of the Holocaust. And the fact that he was actually a very difficult man, as he was perfectly entitled to be, bearing in mind all the horrors that he'd lived through.
So normally when I force my family to listen to The Rest Is History, when it finishes, when the episode finishes, there's sort of a slight sense, a palpable and a deplorable sense of, thank God that's over.
Or was that it?
But with this, we actually had we were driving up to Northumberland through the sort of the rain or whatever. And we had a really interesting conversation in the car about whether or not, do we expect the survivors of great traumatic events to be victims only, to be saints, whether we expect, and specifically actually, I think, because I don't think it's just survivors. Jonathan Friedland said it's not just survivors of the Holocaust, it's survivors in general. But I think it's also Jews. And I think we there's a sort of cultural expectation in the West that Jews will play the part of saintly victims post-Holocaust. Don't you think, Tom? And people are uncomfortable.
Well, I think that narrative is slightly complicated by the fact that Israel emerged in the wake of the Holocaust.
But that's exactly the point. That's why I think Israel is so unsettling for some people, because it's a heavily armed, a militarized society. Obviously, people do their service in the IDF and all that stuff. And obviously, it's history with the Palestinians. And I think a lot of people find that unsettling, in part because they are used to seeing Jews as victims only. Don't you think?
Well, I think that has been the tradition. And I think that was absolutely the tradition that Israel, you know, the founders of Israel were absolutely determined to...
Yeah, agreed.
To turn their backs on.
Yeah.
Kind of resurrect the tradition of David and Solomon and so on.
Yeah.
But I haven't listened to the episode yet. We'll do when we start driving down south. But I think as I can't remember if I said this at the beginning of the first episode, that obviously the Holocaust is such a huge subject in the sweep of global history that we had to do it.
Yeah, of course.
But there was a kind of degree of nervousness about how we would do it and how that topic would kind of blend with the jaunty theme tune and all that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But my memory of recording it with Jonathan, we did it, Jonathan Friedland, which we did 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, was that it was he's a pretty impressive speaker, isn't he? I mean, he's a very seasoned broadcaster, but the kind of the moral... historical authority that he brought to the subject, you know, I mean, I don't think we could have done that. So we're very grateful to him for having
agreed.
Come on.
I think he was one of our, I think he was probably one of our best ever guests, I would say.
Yes.
I mean, we've had guests who were, you know, we've had Bart Van Lewis guests who do a great performance and stuff. But on a subject like this, I thought Jonathan Friedland spoke with immense, as you said, authority, reflectiveness, and personal investment in the subject, because, of course, he's lived with Rudolf Werber's story for so long, wanted to write it since he was 19 and all that.
And I mean, just reading his book and then having to think about it and then do the episodes is quite draining. I mean, it's it's not cheery, but to have written the book, to have lived with all that for so long, can't, you know. Anyway, if you haven't listened to them, I do commend them to you. I think they're very powerful episodes.
So let's talk about something, I mean, now a complete change of tone. The Rest is History World Cup, which we referred to earlier, that was where we did our, God, is there anyone alive who hasn't heard us say this 1,000 times? our 32-team marathon.
Yeah.
And we never need to say it again now, Tom.
No.
But there was a poll on the Discord. So for those of you who are new members, new Athelstan members, or indeed just general club members, you've got it for Christmas. There is a Discord channel, which is a kind of online forum where members of the Rest is History Club are actually remarkably polite to each other, by and large, I would say, Tom, wouldn't you?
Yes, by and large, yeah.
So they've had a vote. I wasn't terribly happy with the draw, I have to say, because I thought to see Denmark go out in the quarterfinals, I was quite shocked about that.
Crashing out to Canada.
The Beavers beat the rescue the Danish Jews.
Yeah.
What does that say about our members, Tom? Nothing good.
However, I think it says I think it says a lot that's very good about the top quality of that episode.
I think there's a lot of Canadians who basically have been gagging for Canadian episodes for 300 episodes, and finally they got what they wanted and they were determined to. So anyway, the final, it was Sam the Burgundian Wang. Hats off to you, Sam. You did an amazing job putting this polling thing together, going onto the Discord every day to kind of badger people into voting, doing the draw, all of this sort of stuff. The final, the two episodes that were people's favourites.
I think it was the final that the fans wanted, really, wasn't it? I mean, a bit like Argentina and France, the two great colossi.
So Germany and Canada.
Germany and Canada. So Germany, the White Rose. I think the most moving episode that we've done.
That was a good episode.
The most moving episode we've done.
Yeah.
And the Beavers, which...
Tom, is there not a part of you that thinks deep down that this, that people will remember this World Cup for Costa Rica and that Costa Rica should have been in the final?
Yes, I do. So Dr. Valverde, I think, has been the breakout star, hasn't he?
Yes.
He's kind of been the Mbappe of of this World Cup.
Yeah.
So sad to see him not make the final and adorn the final. But I think that the Beaver, I mean, I think the Beaver's been a great addition to the World Cup as well.
I suppose so, but not as great as Sophie Scholl. Sophie Scholl, of course, denied in previous World Cups.
Yeah.
Finally got the
Lionel Messi
gold medal.
Of...
Yeah. She finally got the recognition that she has long deserved. So it's interesting, actually, isn't it? Sam, in his sort of briefing notes for us, says it's interesting how one of the more emotional, hard-hitting podcasts came out on top. So we had such a range of topics. So we had some that were sort of quite panoramic. We had some that were...
very focused in, very close up.
Yeah, we had some that were sort of wars, you know, like the Rif War or whatever. We had some that were like, you know, Diocletian. So Diocletian could have been a standard Restus History. He's a massive figure.
Yeah.
It could have been a normal Restus History episode.
Nishanti as well, I think, could have been.
Absolutely.
Normal.
Or indeed the Caliphate of Cordoba. Fascinating subject, something that people have been asking us to do for a long time. Costa Rican Civil War, we would never have done in a million. I mean, if we'd done a million episodes of the Restus History, that wouldn't have been, if Costa Rica hadn't qualified for the World Cup.
And I think that Dr. Valverde broke through because the whole point was I knew nothing about it. So I had no qualms in just making up.
Yeah.
I'm afraid calumnies against this noble and dignified man.
You still
have apologized. I've made an apology.
But you haven't publicly.
I made an apology on Twitter.
Have you?
Yes, I did.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
To Edgar Valverde, his descendant?
No, not to him.
All right.
But if you think that I should make another public apology, I will.
I don't think you can apologise enough, Tom.
Well, I'm following the strategy of Buckingham Palace in general, and I'm never apologising and never explaining.
So over Christmas, I read Paul Theroux's book, The Old Patagonian Express, where it does an amazing thing that I've always wanted to do, and I've never got around to reading the book. He gets on a train in Boston, a commuter train, first thing in the morning. And basically, he keeps changing trains until he gets to Patagonia.
And you can do that, can you?
Well, he sometimes has to cheat a bit. He gets the equivalent of a rail replacement bus or a taxi over borders and things.
Yeah, okay.
But he does it as much as possible. And at one point, he does go through Costa Rica. He doesn't mention Don Pepe.
Did he like it?
Dr. Valverde or the Civil War. And do you know what? He doesn't like it as much as...
Well, he's very grumpy, isn't he, Paul Theroux? I mean, he didn't like our beautiful seaside towns here in Britain either.
Well, I was thinking about that because The Kingdom by the Sea, which was one of his later travel books, he wrote it in 1982. He did that probably about 6 or 7 years after doing the Old Patagonian Express. And I thought, how bizarre to go from writing about traveling through Honduras or Guatemala or something, Colombia with all the drugs gangs at their peak in those days.
And then going to Liverpool.
Yeah, to go from that to Blackpool.
Yeah.
Staying in boarding houses while people are watching the Falklands War on the telly, gathered around this little sort of guest house. Such a strange... Anyway, this is a complete tangent.
So that's what you read. Anything else? Any history?
I don't actually read history for pleasure, Tom.
Do you not?
I know you find that scandalous, but... So I read some Henry James. I read some Henry James short stories.
Unreadable.
No, I find Henry James quite like a bit of a workout.
Henry James is the one great author I've never managed to cope.
Really?
Portrait of a Lady, I tried. I've read the short ones. Daisy Miller and...
Turn of the Screw?
Turn of the Screw.
Must have read the Turn of the Screw.
So I read Our Mutual Friend instead, which was great.
Right. So of the three big Henry James, the three big late period that are impenetrable, The Wings of the Dove, The Golden Bowl, The Ambassadors, I've read the first two. And I have to say, it took me months because I would fall asleep after every page. But also, the sentence would have started 5 pages earlier.
But do you enjoy it then? I mean, is it just kind of like going for a very long run?
Yeah, it's exactly what it's like.
Or you're reading it because it's there.
It's bracing. It's bracing.
Like climbing Everest.
It's like a walk on a Northumbrian beach when you're under-equipped, you haven't brought the right coat.
But you're going to do it anyway.
And you're going to do it anyway. And you sort of think, and at the end you think, oh, I'm glad I did that. I feel so virtuous.
Oh, Dominic, if you do that walk along the Northumbrian beach that I recommended, I should warn you.
Yeah.
Actually, Arthur might enjoy it, but there's a decapitated seal on the beach.
Oh, my God. No, I don't think any of us would enjoy that, Tom. A decapitated man, that's a different matter. He'd enjoy that, but not a decapitated seal.
Well, anyway, so that's something for you to look forward to. And maybe you'll see the walrus. So there's a walrus that's been going around Britain.
Yes,
turning up
I saw that.
And behaving very badly. indulging in the sin of onanism.
He spoilt people's new year in some way.
Yes, because he was on a pier wanking.
Oh, God.
And so they had to cancel the fireworks in case they disturbed him. Anyway, I don't know how we got to marine mammals.
Let's talk about Jesus, Tom. Let's talk about Jesus.
We should always talk about Jesus.
There have been almost 500 responses so far to the episode on the Discord channel.
And I don't think that's surprising, is it? We knew that there was going to be a wide range of responses to this.
Sometimes I have a look at that Discord page, that thread, and I just think, I just don't know where to start. You know, it's like a foreign language, frankly.
It was a topic in which lots and lots of people have enormous investment and enormous wealth of knowledge.
Yeah. And very strong, yeah, very, very strong opinions.
And those are always the topics that one prepares to do a podcast on with some trepidation. But I think we just about got away with it.
I suppose one of the big things that people asked about, so Andrew H. touches on this. He says he wants to ask about talking about history and faith. This is you, Tom, being in different magisteria. And quite a lot of the comments, or at least the early comments before I passed out through just confusion and bewilderment. But a lot of the comments talked about the fact that, you know, people said, oh, well, you can't quite get to the truth of it because you're talking as historians and you seem to think that historians can't trade in the supernatural and all of that.
You know, I do think that. I don't think that you can give explanations for what happens in the dimension of history in supernatural terms. I mean, you know, there is a long tradition beginning with Eusebius or going right the way up, you know, I suppose they're still being written to this day where you say, well, it happened fundamentally because God willed it.
Mm.
But that, by explaining everything, explains nothing, really. But having said that, I did say that I think that at the heart of Christianity and Islam, the beginnings of them, there are two imponderable mysteries that kind of defy reductive attempts by historians to explain them. One of them is why did people believe in the resurrection?
Yeah.
And I think it's beyond our ability as historians to explain why that is. And so that does leave room if you want to believe that it was a supernatural occurrence. It leaves space for people to believe that, I think. And the other one is why people seem people who thought that the Quran was a divine revelation, they always seem to have thought that.
Yeah.
And what it was about the circumstances in which the Quran emerged that made people think that, again, I think is, you don't have to believe the standard Islamic accounts to accept that there is something quite mysterious there, I think. And I think that's great because I think that a sense of mystery should be a part of,
yeah,
you know, the perspective that you're bringing to the subject. Because we talked about this, the problem with being a historian, if you're dealing with periods where people believe in the supernatural and where the gods are close and the divine is close or angels or whatever, is that the discipline of history doesn't have space in its discourse for figures like that, for the understanding like that. And yet your 21st perspective risks becoming antiseptic. It risks being the equivalent, as I said, of putting a pin through a butterfly.
Mm.
And I think that that is a challenge in dealing with supernatural beliefs. And I think that I have always found in writing about periods and peoples where they believe things that to a 21st century perspective would seem ridiculous, that you kind of have to have almost two pages open, one in which you're in the 21st century and the other in which you are accepting that when people say they see an angel, they are seeing an angel.
That's how I feel when I'm writing about the Benites, Tom, in the 1970s.
Well, yeah, to a degree, if you think that, you know, you don't have political sympathy with a political figure in the 70s, you still have to understand. I mean, you have to try and get in their shoes and see the world through their eyes. Yeah.
So those examples that you give are not the only examples where the supernatural, of course, intrudes in history. So I've always thought about when I was in my first year as an undergraduate and I was writing about the sieges of Constantinople or something like that by the Arabs or by the Slavs or the Vikings or whoever. And at one of these moments, I mean, this happened all the time in sieges of Constantinople, the emperor or the patriarch appears with the veil of the Virgin or an icon or whatever. And the sources sort of say, well, this repelled the invaders and they went away. And I can remember my tutor who was died tragically young, actually, a guy called Mark Witto.
Yeah,
who wrote traffic about,
accident, wasn't it? Yeah,
exactly. He wrote about Byzantine Empire in the sort of 8th, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. He was talking about this, and he talked about this as though it had happened. And I said to him, What? I mean, you don't really think the icon shot a ray out and kind of dispelled it. And he said, well, how do you know it didn't?
Yeah.
And it was an interesting,
yeah.
I'd never thought of the challenge. I never thought before the challenge that historians of this, of any sort of pre-modern period face, that you have to grapple with the fact that probably things happened that a lot of people, you know, that you attempted to sort of explain away as a secular skeptic.
Yeah.
And of course, I don't think that it shot a ray out and dispelled the invading hordes or anything like that. But you have to kind of take that seriously.
Well, I think also, I think that with Christianity or Islam, which are living religions, maybe it's easier for historians to recognize the dimension of faith that is animating people. But my bugbear is people who assume, say, the Romans had, you know, that it was all cynicism, that the cults of the gods and everything. Believe any of it. It was all nonsense. They just did it to try and keep the masses in order and all this kind of stuff, which is such a 20th century perspective. And actually the Romans believed all kinds of mad stuff. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand the Romans at all.
Yeah.
And did it with the Greeks, where there's this idea that they're all kind of, you know, rationalists who kind of precursors of the Enlightenment, everything. They weren't at all. I mean, even the philosophers, I mean, they believed all kinds of mad shit.
But Tom, isn't it true as well that the Romans or the Greeks, you could believe all this or live in a world in which, you know, you take all this completely for granted, but you could still be a cynical person and seek to manipulate it for your own political ends. But that doesn't mean that you don't believe it.
But that's true of every period. I mean, that's true Christian Europe or the Islamic world. Of course.
So all the sort of the corrupt popes or whatever, I mean, it doesn't mean that they're not Christians.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, they're just sinful people as we all are.
Well, or they have a different understanding of what is required of them. So the notorious corrupt popes, all the ones, you know, become pope at the age of 23 and toast the devil in their stables and all that kind of thing. These stories are written about them in the wake of the Gregorian Revolution, in which the popes become crusading, mm-hmm. morally determined to cleanse the whole of Christendom pure. And so the failure of earlier popes to do that makes them seem, well, literally diabolical. You know, you've got to be aware that when you look back at the popes, say, of the late 10th, early 11th century and cast them in that light, you are looking through Gregorian lenses.
Yeah. All right. I know I've started you off now on the papacy, and that's a black hole into which I don't wish to tumble immediately.
But we will at some point.
Of course. Of course. Now, let's talk about Sherry. Tom.
Yes.
Because we did a lovely podcast with
Henry Jeffries.
That was brilliant. It was preceded by a lot of bickering about whether or not we'd do whiskey. You emerged triumphant from that.
And we did
do whiskey because I arrived late at the venue saying, who wants to do whiskey? Who cares about whiskey?
A rookie's error.
Yeah. And it turned out he's the editor of like World Whiskey or something.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
So it was a rookie error to turn up late and then to diss whiskey to its great champion. But the question is about sherry. Handle with Claire says, I didn't know anyone still drank sherry. I associate it with old people. My first thought for Christmas would be brandy. That surprises me.
That's true. No, well, because you put it on the Christmas pudding, don't you, and then light
it. You do, but I don't drink brandy at Christmas. Do you?
No. I've never drunk brandy.
Sherry. I think sherry is a much maligned drink. I think we discussed this.
Handel also says, could this just be the differences in weather, but the choices surprised me, so I was interested to know if they were typical for others. I mean, to be honest, the choices were determined by what he'd written about in his book, and we wanted to give it a festive spin. So
they were, but you would drink champagne at Christmas sometimes, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
we would have a glass of champagne or New Year.
But the story of port and sherry, I mean...
That's great.
Of course,
I love all that.
I know. I mean, they're not particularly festive, but the story...
Port is very festive, Tom. What are you talking about? Port and Stilton or something?
Yes, I guess. I guess.
Cliff Beach says, if you want to hear what an intoxicated Tom and Dominic would sound like doing an episode, listen to one of the Rest is History Club shows at 3/4 speed. I discovered this by accident a few days ago walking my dog and fumbling with my phone with winter gear on. Actually, the truth of the matter is, Tom, we had a very small glass of... Henry's top quality port.
Yeah, so, I did. Well, I'm always very nervous of port because it always gives me a headache. So
really?
Yeah, I don't really like it.
I don't find that at all, actually. Quite the reverse.
Well, that's because you're a Whig.
Yeah.
With your wiggery. Yeah.
No, I'm not a Whig. Well, I suppose I...
Yeah, with your fondness of port. So that discovery of the putting him on fast forward, that was why my mother could never listen to the podcast. And I'd say, you know, did you enjoy it? And she said, I just think you talk very fast. Why are you talking so fast? And I couldn't work out what she was talking about, and then realized that she had it on kind of, you know, took about 5 minutes to listen to the whole thing.
But that's how Jack, the editor, when he was editing these podcasts, I think he's devolved that now to some of his orcs. But he said he listened to them all at double speed or something. Did you know that, Tom?
Yeah,
he never listened to them just straight. I mean, I think that's a very bad habit, but there you go.
2022 history. So this was our roundup of the year, wasn't it? Dreadnought. Do people really think the Ukraine war would be remembered by history in 100 years? Will it not just blur into that period when Russia pushed its borders westward whilst it became authoritarian before this guy called Putin was toppled, died, and they opened up their country to democracy? Do many people now talk about Lenin invading Poland in 1920?
They do. I talk about it all the time. Yeah. No, I think the Polish-Soviet war is a brilliant war. Very interesting.
No, but you may talk about it, but it's not part of the general discourse, is it?
Poles talk about it.
Yeah.
Okay. The miracle on the Vistula. I think, will it be remembered in 100 years?
Too early to tell, perhaps you could say.
It's too early. So I said in that episode, didn't I, about 9/11, that I thought as time goes on, 9/11's significance kind of, obviously not for Americans, it's still a sort of, dare I say, a sacral moment, Tom, for Americans. But outside, I think 9/11 is its significance is decreasing year on year.
Well, but say there are other terrorist spectaculars, then its saliency would rise up again.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It's kind of kaleidoscopic effect in terms of the events that we in the present think of as being significant.
Yeah.
And they're determined by events and by changes in society and all kinds of things.
Yeah, so to Dreadnought's question, I mean, we can't possibly know how people will remember the war in Ukraine, but imagine that it led to,
the overthrow of Putin.
Yeah, then definitely.
Or the breakup of Russia. Then it would clearly be very remembered.
If it becomes kind of like the Iran-Iraq war, so a war that just goes on and on and on, very grim, with no great, sort of endless stalemate, then I suppose, because who remembers, I mean, people remember the Iran-Iraq war in Iran and Iraq, especially in Iran, I think. But do people talk about it in the rest of the world? They don't really, do they? But I remember in the 80s, I mean, it was on the news night after night, wasn't it? Sort of item number 8, there's been yet more killing or whatever. It's interesting. I mean, there's a massive conversation to be had about how we, as it were, narrativize history, how we pick out
the
moments.
But also, I mean, the reason for that is that Iran and Iraq seem foreign to us, as Europeans, in a way that Ukraine and Russia don't. And so Russia in particular has always been such a huge presence, brooding presence often, in European history, that anything that relates to Russian history, anything that has a kind of decisive impact, will be remembered. So I think we definitely still remember the 1989.
And then the coup in 91.
The coup.
The attempted coup.
And I think that if this does lead to the overthrow of Putin and perhaps the disintegration of Russia, I mean, neither I think are impossible, then it will definitely be commemorated. But yeah, I mean, too early to tell. Who can say? James Parkhouse, Dominic.
Yeah.
He's in disagreement with you, and he's normally in agreement with you.
That's shocking.
On the subject of Britain's standing in the world being changed by recent events, he thinks you're wrong.
James, you started the year in terrible form.
Well, he's ending it, to be fair.
Yeah.
Ending 2022. James has been married to a Mexican for 20 plus years, visits there regularly, as well as living and working in India, and is lucky, therefore, to have a wide circle of international friends. They have consistently commented on what they see as Britain becoming less stable and more like them. It started with Brexit, but the drumbeat of stories that have a reach outside the New York Times is no positive and has accelerated this year.
Okay, so a couple of answers to that. One is James hears people talk about that because he is British, I'm guessing, or because he's an English speaker, he's an Anglophone. So people talk about it more to him than they would probably among themselves. I don't believe, he's married to a Mexican, but I don't believe in the kind of the streets of Puebla. People are discussing
Liz Truss
and Brexit. I think it's highly implausible. I also think that it's easy to forget that, you know, people would have been having those, we talked about Paul Theroux and his travel around the coastal towns in 1982. I mean, people were undoubtedly having these conversations in the 1970s and the 1980s. This idea that people have constantly talked about Britain as this sort of, you know, they've held up Britain as this paragon of stability in the past is just not the case. That's not always been the way.
I mean, I suppose people have a kind of vague sense of countries, don't they? Almost maybe it's kind of synesthetic taste. And so they may have a vague sense, you know, that it's all chaos. I mean, I think, likewise with America under Trump, they were very right. Kind of, what is going on?
But how often has the British stereotype of France been constant riots in the streets, presidents who come to power promising to fix things and then they never fix them?
Well, or alternatively, wonderful fast trains that zip you through the countryside.
Yeah.
All that kind of, the kind of the beauties and wonders of French civilization, also very much a part of the...
Absolutely. I mean, what people... So basically, middle-class holidaymakers will say of France, it's absolutely wonderful. You know, I went to the south of France this year, or I went to, the Ile de Ré, or I went to the Dordogne. Beautiful. Everything worked, all that kind of thing.
Have you been to the Ile de Ré?
I've never been to the Ile de Ré. I've never been to the Dordogne either.
There's a very amusingly named place there called Arse.
Thanks for that.
And we went there. And Jamie, who's with me in your house right now.
He is.
A friend. And he ate an arse because he thought it would be amusing. It's Andouillette, isn't it?
Oh, God. So, jeez.
He just thought it would be funny and that the humour of it lasted until his first mouthful when he realised he'd made a terrible mistake.
Oh, God.
So if you ever find yourself in the beautiful town of Arse, don't eat an arse. That would be my advice.
No, but I think going back to that France thing, I think... people trade in these sort of stereotypes. So in other words, if they go on there on holiday or they have a second home, a holiday home, they say, gosh, the trains work. Because of course they do, because you're not getting a commuter train at 7:10 in the morning into Paris from the sort of tower block suburbs. So of course it seems like everything works. Or if you're watching it on TV, you're watching the news and you only see the news about France once every month, you say, God, they're always burning tires and, the Gilets Jaunes, and the Front National and all that sort of thing. And in both cases, you miss the texture and the complexity.
Of course.
Of kind of, you trade in generalizations. That's obviously what people are doing at the moment.
At the same time, clichés because they hold up a mirror to an element of truth. And those clichés may be in tension. Anyway. So one last thing where I have to put my hand up, and this was pointed out by Zep B on the Discord,
right.
And also by a number of other people, is that, Dominic, I disgrace myself with science.
You made a brilliant mistake, Tom, in the context of you laughing at me about my lack of knowledge of science.
Yeah, I know. I humiliated myself. All I can say is that story of the British scientists in the 90s claiming that they'd got cold fusion and announcing it to the world and then nobody being able to do it and them having to apologise, I think struck me as such a nightmarish thing that I assumed that this was what people were carrying on with. But apparently it's not. It's something different.
No,
it's a different kind of fusion.
But it's also, Tom, it's not the only scientific mistake in the podcast in recent weeks. Because wasn't there a mix-up between Werner von Braun and Werner Heisenberg?
Yes, there was.
Werner Heisenberg?
Yeah.
In the Danish Jews episode. Another moment where you tried to introduce science to the podcast.
I know. I should accept my ignorance on that score.
We just shouldn't do it. So,
yeah.
Yes, so not of this level of the Dr. Valverde incident.
Well, but and not. Also, I listened to the alcohol one, the festive drinks one, coming here, and we were talking about the Royal Academy, and I'm sure we meant the Royal Society. So I noticed that one as well.
Do you know, Tom, sometimes people sort of say, oh, you got this wrong, or you did this. And I always say, so we're not an encyclopedia, we're not an academic monograph, we're a podcast. And so although we do obviously always try to get our facts right, and we don't make mistakes for the sake of it, and we do our homework, believe it or not, we don't beat ourselves up too much.
I'll tell you, my worst one was saying that Carinus' census was in AD 8. It wasn't.
When was it?
It was AD 6 or 7. But I'll tell you, I know exactly why I said that, was that Herod the Great died in 4 BC.
Yeah.
And I thought 2 times 4 is 8, and that's why I said 8. Madness. But anyway, yeah, but that is part of the fun of doing the podcast, is that occasionally things are, we're unplugged, aren't we?
We sometimes have, I mean, we did these, we've got these 4 episodes to come about the Weimar Republic and the creation of the National Socialist Party and the rise to power of the Nazis. And we had billions of pages of notes for that, because it's an important subject, you don't want to make mistakes. But at the same time, with the podcast, we're always trying to you know, there's a degree of spontaneity and informality to it, which means that sometimes we're talking off the cuff and misremembering things and all of that. So I think generally members of this club are pretty forgiving, aren't they, Tom?
By and yes, large. They are. While at the same time, always being ready to point yeah. out our errors, for which we are grateful and in no way think that we're not grateful. And of course, Dominic, we are also incredibly grateful for your support. So thank you so much for that. As we end the year and begin a new year.
Particularly grateful, Tom, to our new members, because I think there are quite a few people who joined because of the World Cup, because of the Jesus episodes, or because they were given membership for Christmas. So thank you so much to you for listening. We have, many people have heard us say this 1,000 times, but we have lots of really, really fun subjects coming up in the next few weeks and months. And we have live events and all kinds of things. So it should be a really, fingers crossed, it will be a really good year for the rest of history. I noticed that Arena of the Wokerati on the Discord said she hoped that we didn't get burnt out and we remained excited about what we do. I think we're pretty excited, aren't we, Tom?
Well, I think you can see how excited we are that both of us are on holiday and we've ended up in we've ended up in a house in Northumbria together.
Yeah, we absolutely haven't been compelled to do that by the production team, and anyone who says that we were is lying.
Yeah.
So you've got Auschwitz this week. Next week is Lady Jane Grey, Tom, I think.
Yes.
Long anticipated.
Which we've been promising for a long time, almost as long as pigeons.
We recorded that. When did we record that?
I think in August.
Crikey. But it's jolly good, actually, isn't it? The Lady Jane Grey, I think.
As I remember, but I can't really remember anything about it.
I'm looking forward to hearing it again, actually.
It was a kind of one, a classic one where we thought, wow, I don't know, maybe we could stretch that to an episode. We ended up doing two.
Yeah. So we do it in real detail. And I remember that being pretty good. And then we've got the Nazis, which is obviously another bleak subject. But I'd be really interested to see what people make of that. Because I think we went into it quite
detail. Yeah,
quite a lot of detail. It's 4 hours worth of stuff there.
And I bring my expert knowledge of Horst Wessel to the table, don't I?
Tom had to be dissuaded from...
making a whole episode about Horst Wessel.
Yeah, I was about to say, from doing endless impersonations. There were no impersonations at all in the Nazi series. You'll be very pleased to hear. Because that really would have been the fast track to cancellation.
But there will be impersonations coming up. Because we've got Reagan, haven't we?
You got a lot of love for your Ronald Reagan noise.
A little glimpse, a little taste there, an amuse bouche, as yeah. the people who live in metropolitan circles in London like yes. to put it.
Yeah, there's no amuse bouches up here in Northumberland.
Starter.
Yeah. Happy New Year, everybody, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.